Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a PGY1 transitional year resident. In today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about some stuff relating to Reno. This is basically going to be a complete Reno review for the USMLE Step 1. This is going to be in two parts. This will be the first of two parts. So let's begin. So, slide number one. A patient taking a diabetes medication presents with a chief complaint of flank pain and dysuria, right? So what's the diagnosis here, right? So if a patient has flank pain and dysuria, and let's assume they have fever, I would really hope you're thinking about pyelonephritis. Remember, pyelonephritis causes flank pain versus cystitis that causes suprapubic pain. And the pathophysiology here, right? So diabetes medication, right? And pyelonephritis, right? That makes you think of a UTI. So hopefully that gets you thinking about the SGLT2 inhibitors, like a canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin, okay? They basically inhibit the sodium glucose linked transporter that you find at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule. So you basically waste the glucose in the urine. Those drugs work really well. They lower your blood glucose really well, but they also cause a lot of glucosuria, right? Which can basically create a wonderful like buffet for bacteria and fungi, right? And they can basically cause a lot of problems in your nephron, so they can cause UTIs. Now, the apical surface modification shared by the PCT in relation to the small bowel, that's microvilli. Remember, the proximal tubule has a simple cuboidal epithelium, but it has microvilli. Remember, microvilli constitutes the brush border that's also found in your GI tract. And the driving force for reabsorption in the nephron is essentially the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. Remember that this pump basically makes sodium an extracellular ion and potassium an intracellular ion, right? So it pumps three sodiums out of the cell and two potassiums in. And then PTH, that's parathyroid hormone, also think of it as the phosphate trashing hormone. Its effects are the proximal convoluted tubule are that PTH essentially, so the way phosphate is reabsorbed in the proximal tubule is that phosphate is reabsorbed concurrently, right, in a simple order with sodium. So again, remember, sodium is primarily an extracellular ion, right? So as sodium flows down its gradient into the cell, phosphate can follow alongside, okay, in a SymPort. That's a kind of a secondary active transport, if you may. That transporter, the endocytosis of that transporter is actually increased by parathyroid hormone, okay? And then with regards to reclaiming bicarb at the level of the proximal tubule, basically, if you filter bicarb from the glomerulus into Bowman's space and then into the proximal tubule, that bicarb will combine with hydrogen ions, okay? And then it will form a carbonic acid. And then an enzyme known as carbonic anhydrase will split off that carbonic acid into water and carbon dioxide. Those diffuse across the membrane of the proximal convoluted tubule cell, okay? And then they are reconverted back by, I guess, a more intracellular isoform of carbonic anhydrase into bicarb, which goes to the blood side through the basolateral side of the PCT cell. And then the hydrogen ions are extruded back into the urine side to keep the cycle going. As those hydrogen ions are extruded, remember to maintain electron neutrality, sodium ions are actually brought in, right? So there's like a sodium hydrogen antiporter. As hydrogen comes out, sodium comes in. And that transporter specifically, its activity is increased by angiotensin 2. So that's why if you're in a volume depleted state, right? So if you're in a volume contracted state, if you may, as angiotensin 2 does its job more and more, because remember, if your volume down, you'll increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. As hydrogen ions are coming out, okay, as hydrogen ions are coming out, you're basically causing an alkalosis, right? That's why it is said that angiotensin 2 maintains a contraction alkalosis. Now, potassium and acid-base balance with dorzolamide administration, right? So dorzolamide is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, right? So because it kind of sounds like acetazolamide, right? So because it inhibits carbonic anhydrase, right? You basically waste bicarb in your urine, right? So you basically get a metabolic acidosis with taking dorzolamide. In fact, if you want to be a little more specific, you get a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. And if you actually want to be a little super more specific, right? You actually get a type 2 renal tubular acidosis, right, a proximal RTA from taking a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. And then because dorzolamide is a diuretic, right, it makes you volume down. So if it makes you the volume down, that should increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. And if your RAS system is upregulated, right, your levels of aldosterone will increase. And if you think about the principal cell, right, that will essentially make sodium be that will increase the activity of that INEC channel at the principal cell. Sodium will get into the lumen of your, I mean, I guess go intracellular for the principal cell of your collecting duct, and that will create a negative charge on the urine side that will draw potassium, okay? So you get a hypokalemia because it's a diuretic. Now, if you compare the beginning and the end of the proximal tubule, right? So at the beginning of the proximal tubule, basically, across the proximal convoluted tubule, you reabsorb sodium and water basically at the same rate. So the sodium concentration really doesn't change. Contrast that with chloride, where at the early part of the proximal convoluted tubule, you reabsorb more water than chloride. So the concentration of chloride actually goes up. And then towards the end of the proximal convoluted tubule, you actually reabsorb more chloride than water. So the chloride concentration ultimately goes down. So there's an initial uptick in the concentration of chloride and then a downtick. And I've talked about the PCT-mediated acid-base response in the setting of volume depletion. So I've talked about that. That's the contraction, alkalosis, angiotensin II business. And then at what plasma glucose level does glucose begin to show up in the urine? That will be at a plasma glucose of about 200, okay? It's actually kind of high yield to know that. So remember, at the proximal tubule, right, it's again sodium glucose link transporter, an SGLT2 transporter that helps make that happen. Contrast that with SGLT1 that you find more in the GI tract. So at a plasma glucose level of like 200 mg per deciliter, you'll begin to find the glucose showing up in the urine, okay? And then the next question says, at what plasma glucose level are all SGLT2 transporters saturated, right? That will actually be at a much higher level, at a level of 375, okay? So you may say, wait, Divine, that doesn't make any sense. How would you begin to see glucose in the urine at a plasma glucose level of 200 when all the SGLT2 transporters are not saturated? The reasoning behind that is the SGLT2 transporters have different properties. Some get saturated at much lower plasma glucose levels than others, okay? So each of those transporters have different mechanics. So because they have different mechanics, you can sort of imagine that you may begin to see glucose in the urine at different plasma glucose levels. In fact, that phenomenon, right? So basically, the thing that's responsible for the phenomenon I'm discussing with these last two questions is the concept known as splay, S-P-L-A-Y, okay? And then the last question here says there are three high yield conditions that have an association with pellagra, right? So pellagra, right? So pellagra is a vitamin B3 or a niacin deficiency. I discussed that in the biochem reviews. So there are three high yield things that can cause this, right? One is you're just not consuming enough niacin in the diet, right? So that can give you pellagra. Another thing that could happen is you could have carcinoid syndrome. So remember, in carcinoid syndrome, you essentially have a tumor that's making a ton of serotonin. If you remember from a previous podcast, I mentioned that another name for serotonin is 5-HT, 5-hydroxytryptophan. So if you're diverting all your tryptophan towards the synthesis of serotonin, if a person has like carcinoid syndrome, you can already begin to imagine that you have less tryptophan available for the synthesis of niacin, and then you can run into trouble with pellagra. Another thing that could also happen is if a patient has like Hartnup disease. So Hartnup disease, I discussed this in the biochem reviews, right? But as a quick review again, Hartnup disease, you essentially have a problem with the transporter that brings in neutral amino acids at the level of the proximal tubule. Is also a defect in the GI tract because that transporter is also found in the GI tract. But if you have a deficiency of that transporter, you cannot reabsorb neutral amino acids like tryptophan. And if you cannot bring in tryptophan, you basically have no feedstock for the synthesis of niacin. So that can also cause a pellagra-like presentation. And I mean, generally, for those things, you want to go ahead and just replace like niacin in the diet. You can give like nicotinic acid or whatever it's called. Okay, and please don't forget the 4 Ds of pellagra. It's like diarrhea, right? Dermatitis, right? So they'll have like skin findings. They also have dementia, so they're like forgetting things or acting crazy. And then death is the fourth D. So next slide. So a 70-year-old male with a 2-year history of urinary dribbling presents with a 1-day history of severe flank pain and costovertebral angle tenderness, right? So if you see flank pain and CVA tenderness, and hopefully you can decipher that this patient has a BPH, hopefully you're thinking about pyelonephritis, right? And again, the risk factor for this specific patient, right? So old guy with urinary dribbling, that's a benign prostatic hyperplasia, okay? The classic pediatric risk factor for pyelonephritis is something known as a VUR, vesicoureteral reflux, where you essentially have a reflux of urine from the bladder to the ureters, right? So because you're having that reflux, you're introducing a bugs into the urinary system, and that can cause a lot of trouble, right? And the most likely bug, if you're thinking about a UTI, is E. coli. E. coli is the most common cause of UTIs. If you see a person that has these symptoms and their urinary pH is 8, that's super basic. I hope you're thinking about a urease positive bug, right? Potentially like Proteus mirabilis. Another one that is also urease positive that could also cause those kinds of problems is a Staph saprophyticus. But for Proteus mirabilis, that's the most common answer on exams, on MBME exams. The classic culture finding, right, is like swarming motility on agar. Okay, that's just a buzzword you want to try to remember. And then the most likely bug in a sexually active young female, this is actually the second most common cause of UTIs, that would be Staph saprophyticus, okay? And next question says the histologic finding in the chronic form of pyelonephritis, right? So chronic pyelonephritis, classically, if you do like, let's say you do a kidney biopsy and you look at the tissue under the microscope, you actually have a finding known as thyroidization of the kidney. So you may wonder like, huh, Divine, does it mean that thyroid follicles literally go to the kidney? No, that's not what happens, right? That kind of be magic. That doesn't really happen. The thing that actually happens is, remember, the thyroid gland has simple cuboidal epithelium. The convoluted tubules also have simple cuboidal epithelium, right? So in chronic pylo, right, all that inflammation, you can sort of have like a hyaline deposit in the lumen and the lumina, I guess, of those are convoluted tubules. But because they're all surrounded by cuboidal epithelium, just kind of like your thyroid gland, right, you can have that thyroidization appearance of the nephron. And on urinalysis, you'll actually see something known as an eosinophilic cast, okay? Please do not confuse an eosinophilic cast with actual eosinophils. Actual eosinophils in the urine should get you thinking about acute interstitial nephritis, right? Remember, that has a triad of fever, rash, and eosinophilia, okay? But if you see eosinophilic casts, think more about chronic pyelonephritis. And basically, the way you manage pyelonephritis pharmacologically on USML is you give ceftriaxone. That's a third-generation cephalosporin, okay? Another thing you can do is you can give like an IV fluoroquinolone, okay? Those are two high-yield things you want to keep in mind for pyelonephritis. And then the classic demographic for UTIs, right? It's females. Females have a shorter urethra, so that's why there's an increased incidence of UTIs in females. But in pregnant women, right, so pregnancy is a hyperprogesteronic state, if you may, right? So there are very high levels of progesterone in pregnancy. The thing is, progesterone is a smooth muscle relaxant, right? So if you relax the smooth muscles, like in the ureters, for example, that can cause like urinary stasis, right? And that can increase a person's risk of UTIs. Now, the next slide, right, so says to differentiate pyelonephritis from cystitis, right? So pyelonephritis is more severe than cystitis, okay? In pyelonephritis, you actually see white blood cell casts, very high yield to know that, white blood cell casts in the urine. Contrast that with cystitis, where you see no casts in the urine, okay? And the pain in pyelonephritis, right, it's like flank pain, CVA tenderness versus cystitis, that is more suprapubic pain, okay? And fever is pathognomonic for pyelonephritis. Many times on MBMEs, you may not necessarily see fever in the setting of a cystitis. So then the next question says, hematuria in a recent Egyptian immigrant who was previously like a swim instructor, right? So hopefully you're thinking about hemorrhagic cystitis, and hopefully you're thinking about schistosoma hematobium with that, okay? And then same presentation, but this is a patient on chemotherapy. Hope you're thinking about, again, hemorrhagic cystitis, but that's more with cyclophosphamide. Cyclophosphamide, right, remember, it's an alkylating agent that's used as an anti-cancer medication, although it's also used to treat many of the nephritic and nephrotic syndromes. So cyclophosphamide can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. Remember, a metabolite of cyclophosphamide is acrolein. That acrolein is a vesicant. It can basically scrub away your bladder epithelium and cause a hemorrhagic cystitis. So you can kind of prevent that by giving a drug known as Mesna. Mesna binds up acrolein so that you don't have the destruction of the bladder. Okay, remember, cyclophosphamide can actually increase a person's risk of a bladder cancer. And then the next part says, again, hemorrhagic cystitis in the patient with pink eye and sore throat. This is more a viral infection, right? So hopefully you're thinking about adenovirus. Remember, adenoviral infection is known as pharyngoconjunctivitis, right? So pharyngoconjunctivitis. The pharyngo just means that... you have a pharyngo, right? So sore throat conjunctivitis, pink eye, okay, and hemorrhagic cystitis. It's actually really high yield to know that that adenovirus causes a hemorrhagic cystitis. Okay, and then the way you manage cystitis, you can give nitrofurantoin. That's what's commonly known as Macrobid in the hospital. Remember, that can cause a pulmonary fibrosis. You can also give fluoroquinolone, right? So like ciprofloxacin works great for UTIs. Alternatively, you can also give trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, okay, Bactrim. Those things work pretty well for cystitis. And just real quick, nitrofurantoin can be used for cystitis. You do not use nitrofurantoin for pilo. I just thought I should sort of throw that out there. Okay, and then this last question is kind of something you need to know, right? So like 40-year-old female, history of rheumatoid arthritis, presents with a one-year history of recurring episodes of flank pain and dysuria that have not responded to appropriate antibiotics, okay? And a renal biopsy reveals granulomas. Diffuse granulomatous inflammation of the left kidney. This is just something you want to know. It's known as a xanthogranulomatous. So xantho, right? So X-A-N-T-H-O, and then granulomatous pyelonephritis. It's a pretty severe form of pyelonephritis. Really, the only way you can treat it is to get rid of the kidney. That's like the definitive treatment. You basically do a nephrectomy and the patient is cured. But so it's a pretty bad form of a pyelonephritis. And the urinalysis findings in UTIs, right? So like your leukocyte X-rays will be positive. You'll see bacteria in the urine. You'll see positive nitrites, right? You'll see white blood cells in the urine. So you have a pyuria. If you see a sterile pyuria, right? So like you're seeing white cells in the urine, but you're not seeing any box. Think about appendicitis. That's one thing that could classically cause that. And the thing that could cause that is chlamydia. If chlamydia is what's causing the UTI, that can actually cause a sterile pyuria. So sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then the biggest risk factor associated with UTIs in hospitalized patients, that's basically the use of indwelling catheters. Okay, easy question there. Now, next one, a patient with a history of well-controlled CHF is rushed to the ED from a movie theater after he began to complain of severe eye pain. Okay, so let's assume he has glaucoma. He's given an IV formulation emergently while awaiting transfer to a tertiary care center. 3 hours after the patient, 3 hours later, the patient begins to complain of difficulty breathing. Chest auscultation reveals bilateral crackles, which were not present on initial exam. So let's assume this patient has glaucoma, right? So elevated intraocular pressures, right? We could potentially give mannitol for that, right? And remember, mannitol, right? Yeah, it's good for glaucoma, right? And it's also a good diuretic, right? But it's not like if you want to use it as a diuretic, you inject it directly into the kidneys. No. You inject it into the bloodstream first, right? So initially, because mannitol is a non-reabsorbable sugar, right? It doesn't really cross membranes very well. Mannitol can increase your intravascular volume. And if you have like CHF, like congestive heart failure, you cannot handle that extra volume. That can sort of tip you over the edge and you get into trouble pretty quickly. So this patient got mannitol for glaucoma, okay, that expanded his intravascular volume, and let's say his heart could not handle that extra volume, so he went into a congestive heart failure exacerbation, okay. And again, mannitol is a non-reabsorbable sugar. It basically stays in the lumen of the nephron, okay, and pulls water alongside, and then you basically pee it out. But classically, if you look at text, they say that, oh, mannitol works at the proximal tubule, blah blah blah, okay. It technically works all through the nephron, but if you want to go with semantics, oh, it works well in the PCT. The other drug that works well in the PCT is your carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, right? So like acetazolamide or dorzolamide, okay? And again, that works by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, right? And the electrolyte derangements associated with carbonic anhydrase inhibitors. Remember, carbonic anhydrase inhibitors help you waste bicarb in the urine. So if you waste that bicarb in the urine, right, that will cause a metabolic acidosis. Remember, I said it's a NAGMA, a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. If you want to be a little more specific, it's a type 2 RTA. And because your carbonic anhydrase inhibitors are diuretics, they make your volume down. If your volume down, you will... rev up your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So if you remember that principal cell business I discussed earlier, you basically waste potassium in your urine. So you get a hypokalemia. So it's a unique cluster of findings, because usually hypokalemia is associated with a metabolic alkalosis. But if you see the unique combo of hypokalemia and a metabolic acidosis, okay, think about a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Okay, and carbonic anhydrase, right? It's a pretty important enzyme in the synthesis of aqueous humor. So if a patient has glaucoma, you can actually give them a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, and that will decrease the synthesis of aqueous humor, and that can sort of decrease intraocular pressures. Another thing, your acetazolamide can be used for is with central sleep apnea, right? So no one really knows the mechanism why, right? But I mean, I have a teleologic mechanism, if you may, that I can propose, right? So if you sort of think about it this way, if a patient takes acetazolamide, right, because of its role as a diuretic and because of its mechanism of action, you get a metabolic acidosis, right? So if you sort of think about it, the way your body compensates for a metabolic acidosis is with respiratory alkalosis, right? And how do you cause a respiratory alkalosis in a human being? You make them hyperventilate, right? So hyperventilating sort of raises your respiratory rate. So that can potentially help with central sleep apnea, where the problem you have is a decrease the respiratory drive, okay? And mountain sickness, right? If you go to higher elevations, you're kind of hypoxic, right? So your respiratory rate goes up, right? So you get like a respiratory alkalosis, if you may. Your body sort of tries to compensate for that by creating a metabolic acidosis. So the kidney tries to dump bicarb in the urine. You can sort of speed that process along with acetazolamide. Okay, and cola transporter defect, right? So cola transporter defects, I talked about this in the biochem review, but this is basically where you have issues with a transporter that helps you reabsorb basic amino acids at the level of the proximal tubule. If you have trouble reabsorbing those basic amino acids, right? So like cysteine, ornithine, lysine, and arginine, right? One particular problem you can get is cystinuria, right? So you can form like cysteine stones in the urine, right? Remember, they're sort of shaped as hexagons, like benzene rings, if you may. So those cysteine stones, you can actually solubilize them pretty well in a basic environment. So an unusual use of acetazolamide is actually for the treatment of cystinuria, okay? It just basically solubilizes those cysteine stones, and then you don't get into trouble. And remember, cysteine sounds a lot like 16, so that should help you remember that it's those stones are sort of shaped like hexagons. But you can also give sodium bicarb, and that can help with that. Okay. And then the only diuretic that's safe with sulfur allergies, it's a loop diuretic, that's ethacrynic acid. It's a pretty safe, it does not cause sulfur allergies, but it actually has a pretty high risk of ototoxicity, actually compared to the other loop diuretics. Okay, next question. Hemoglobin of 8 and MCV of 85 in a patient with a history of chronic kidney disease, right? So this is a normocytic anemia, right? So hopefully you know that if you have a chronic kidney disease, well, bye-bye peritubular capillaries. And if you're saying bye-bye peritubular capillaries, you're not making EPO. If you're not making EPO, you would not stimulate your red blood cell precursors, right? And you basically stop making red blood cells. So you can get a normocytic anemia in the setting of a chronic kidney disease. Now, the mechanism behind the production, or I guess secretion of, let's call it more production, of EPO, it's kind of like a super high yield basic science thingy that I think is probably useful to know for exams, right? Because it's a nice way for them to integrate renal and cell physiology, or cell biology, if you may, right? So the thing is, there is something known as HIF1 alpha, H-I-F-1 alpha. It's a transcription factor for EPO, okay? If HIF1 alpha is doing its job, you make a ton of EPO, and then EPO can go do what EPO does, right? So the thing is, when you're under conditions where there's enough oxygen around, right? You don't need to make more red blood cells necessarily, right? So you should potentially downregulate your production of EPO, right? So the thing is, when you're under like normal oxygen tension conditions, HIF1 alpha is actually hydroxylated. Remember, hydroxy groups kind of contain oxygen, right? So a good oxygen tension will promote more hydroxylation of HIF1 alpha. If you hydroxylate HIF1 alpha, that actually targets it for degradation, right? And this is why I see that this is a nice cell biology tie-in for step one. There is a ubiquitin, you need to basically polyubiquitinate HIF1 alpha, the hydroxylated form, to have it destroyed. And the ubiquitin ligase that makes that happen is VHL, von Hippel-Lindau. So if HIF1 alpha is hydroxylated, VHL recognizes it, that target, that polyubiquitinates it, and that sends it to the proteasome for degradation. But contrast that with a patient that is hypoxic, right? If you're hypoxic, you obviously want more red blood cells, right? Because if you think about the oxygen carrying capacity equation, if you have more hemoglobin, right, which you can get from having more red blood cells, that would increase your oxygen carrying capacity, right? So when you're under hypoxic conditions, HIF-1-alpha is not hydroxylated. Because it's not hydroxylated, it cannot be recognized by the ubiquitin ligase, VHL. And if that recognition does not happen, so if you're, again, if you're under hypoxic conditions, you're not hydroxylating HIF-1-alpha, it's not recognized by VHL, right? So HIF-1-alpha then does its job by acting as a transcription factor for EPO. And the... that EPO, right, goes and promotes the synthesis of red blood cells, if you may. Okay, next question. Capillary spasms plus a prolonged QT interval in a patient with a history of chronic kidney disease. That's hypocalcemia. Remember, if you have a kidney disease, you essentially have no activity of 1-alpha hydroxylase. And if you have no activity of 1-alpha hydroxylase, you don't convert 25-hydroxy vitamin D, right? That's calcidiol, to 125-dihydroxy vitamin D. Okay, that's calcitriol. So if you cannot make calcitriol from calcidiol, you don't have active vitamin D, and you do not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut. Okay, so you get a hypocalcemia. That's actually a cause of a secondary hyperparathyroidism. We're going to talk about this in a later slide. Okay, now rising creatinine in a patient with a prolonged history of osteoarthritis who takes large amounts of diclofenac, that's an NSAID, on a daily basis. Hopefully you're thinking about like renal failure from chronic NSAID use. NSAIDs can cause a lot of bad problems for the kidneys, right? So they can cause a renal papillary necrosis, okay, that classically presents as like hematuria and like rising creatinine in a patient that just takes pretty high doses of NSAIDs on a pretty routine basis. Remember, there are other things that can cause renal papillary necrosis, right? So like NSAIDs can, that's like the classic thing that causes them on exams. Sickle cell disease is actually another high yield cause of renal papillary necrosis. And then one other thing that can do the trick is diabetes. Yep, diabetes can also cause renal papillary necrosis. In fact, diabetes is the most common cause of renal papillary necrosis in the US. And another thing is, so what do I mean by the carpopedal spasms? Let me just sort of backtrack a little here. Carpopedal spasms, that's kind of like the trousseau sign in a patient that has a hypocalcemia. Basically, if you put a blood pressure cuff and sort of make it tight around the arms of a patient that's hypocalcemic, you will sort of have like these twitching movements of your carpal, basically like movements around your carpal metacarpal joints. Okay, so that can basically present as carpopedal spasms. That's the trousseau sign of hypocalcemia. Another classic physical exam finding in hypocalcemia is the Svostek sign. So you tap the cheek and you basically have like spasms of your, I think it's your masseter muscles, if I'm not mistaken, right? But you basically have like spasms of the cheek. That's the Svostek sign, right? So cheek, C-H, Svostek, C-H as well. It's like C-H-V-O-S-T-E-K, okay? Those are signs of hypocalcemia. And remember that hypocalcemia actually prolongs the QT interval. In fact, as a general rule, any notable electrolyte imbalance that has hypo in the name prolongs the QT interval, right? So like hypocalcemia, hypokalemia, hypomagnesemia, those things all prolong the QT interval. And then this is the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? It's a pretty, it's a system every med student should know about. Basically, right, renin is released from your juxtaglomerular cells, okay, your GG cells, and that converts angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1, okay? And then that angiotensin 1 goes to the lungs, basically, and is converted by the endothelial cells of pulmonary capillaries to angiotensin 2. And then angiotensin 2 does a ton of stuff, right? Like it can go to the brain, increase your thirst response. It can go to the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, and that helps you make a ton of ADH, okay? Another thing that could happen with angiotensin 2 is that it can go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex, okay? And it can increase the synthesis of aldosterone, which is a mineralocorticoid. And then angiotensin 2 is also a powerful vasoconstrictor, okay? It acts on type 1 receptors, so it can constrict the blood vessels, and that can raise your blood pressure because you're essentially increasing your systemic vascular resistance. And then don't forget that angiotensin 2 also has activity at that sodium hydrogen antipodal at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule. And then finally, I know there's one more thing I'm forgetting. Yeah, one other thing angiotensin 2 does is if you look at the efferent arterial, it actually causes a selective vasoconstriction of the efferent arterial. So that sort of raises your GFR. Okay, and then don't forget that your kidneys can also do gluconeogenesis, right? So if a patient's liver is shot, you can basically keep making enough not a great amount, but a decent amount of blood glucose with the kidneys. Now, next question says, what happens to the osmolarity of tubular fluid relative to plasma fluid during the following events, right? So the first one is traversing the thin descending limb of the loop of Henle, okay? Remember, the thin descending loop of the limb of the loop of Henle, right, is kind of like around the medulla, right? And the medulla has a very high salt concentration, right? So the thin descending limb of the loop of Henle is actually just permeable to water. It's not permeable to salt, okay? So your tubular fluid actually becomes hypertonic relative to your plasma fluid. But if you're traversing the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle, right? The thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle actually has like the sodium potassium 2 chloride simp water, right? So that part of the nephron is permeable only to what is it called? It's permeable only to salt, okay, so it's not permeable to water. So because it's not permeable to water, right, your tubular fluid actually becomes hypotonic relative to your plasma fluid. And don't forget that the thin descending limb of the loop of Henle has a simple squamous epithelium versus your thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle that actually has simple cuboidal epithelium. But remember, unlike the proximal convoluted tubule, the simple cuboidal epithelium that constitutes your thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle does not have microvilli, okay? And the key transporters that operate at the level of the thick ascending limb, I would just say that you have that sodium potassium 2 chloride, it's called like the NKCC transporter. That basically brings in one sodium, one potassium, and two chlorides, right? So that sort of maintains electroneutrality. You're bringing in two cations total and two anions total, okay? But the thing is, there is actually a potassium channel as well on the urine side, right? So the apical side that basically pulls out potassium from the lumen, I mean, from the intracellular environment of a thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle cell. And that potassium, as it comes into the urine side, it sort of creates a positive charge. And then that positive charge actually causes paracellular reabsorption of calcium and magnesium. Okay, so those are the high yield transporters that sort of operate at the level of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. So again, calcium and magnesium are reabsorbed in a paracellular fashion. Very high yield to know that specific terminology. That potassium channel that actually helps you extrude potassium to create the positive charge is actually known as a Romke channel. And remember that the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle, that's where your loop diuretics work, and that's where basically bladder syndrome operates. We'll talk about that in a later slide. Now the next question says, expected urinary labs, so BUN to creatinine, urinary sodium, FeNA, and urinary osmolarity in a 65-year-old male with a 6-month history of urinary dribbling, right? So if a patient has a 6-month history of urinary dribbling, and again, it's an old guy, hopefully that gets you thinking of BPH, right? So basically, this is an AKI slide, acute kidney injury slide, right? So you sort of think about it. If a patient has prolonged, AKI, in fact, let me sort of backtrack a little, right? So there are three kinds of AKI, right? So there's like pre-renal, intrarenal, post-renal, right? The most common kind is actually intrarenal. So if a patient has like BPH, right, they have like a chronic or prolonged post-renal obstructive nephropathy, if you may, right? So the thing is, if you have a prolonged post-renal obstructive nephropathy, the thing that happens is that your BUN to creatinine is actually less than 15, okay? Your urinary sodium is actually usually greater than 40. Your FeNA will be greater than 2%, and your urinary osmolarity is usually less than 350. I don't want this podcast to be super long, so I'm going to keep moving. The mechanism is not super, super high yield for step one. The mechanism of a pre-renal, like the values are kind of high yield, so I'll talk about those. But if you have a prolonged post-renal AKI, if you may, that you can get with like the urinary retention of BPH, you'll have like BUN creatinine less than 15, urinary sodium greater than 40, FeNA will be greater than 2%, and your urine osmolarity will be less than 350, okay? And the thing is, the next one question sort of says, expected urinary labs in a patient with an increase in creatinine from 1 to 2.5, 36 hours after undergoing a study for the evaluation of a possible PE, right? So if a patient is being evaluated for PE, right? So you should probably know at this point that you get a CT angiogram, right? That requires some kind of contrast, right? And contrast can cause contrast nephropathy, if you may, right? So it can cause like acute tubular necrosis. And remember that acute tubular necrosis is the most common cause of intrarenal acute kidney injury, right? So The high yield thing you sort of want to commit to memory there is that the urinary labs you observe in acute tubular necrosis is the exact same thing as what you observe in a prolonged post-renal acute kidney injury. So the labs, like the BUN creatinine being less than 15, urinary sodium being greater than 40, FeNA being greater than 2%, and urinary osmolarity being less than 350, is sort of the same thing that obtains in ATN, okay? But the way you differentiate between a prolonged post-renal AKI and ATN is that in ATN, you find like the muddy brown casts, right? So like those are granular epithelial casts in the urine. You find those in ATN, but you actually don't find any casts, at least in general, in a post-renal prolonged AKI. Now, the expected urinalysis and urine microscopy findings in an alcoholic that is found down with an EKG revealing peak T waves, hopefully this gets you thinking about rhabdomyolysis, okay, rhabdomyolysis, right, it can... basically, if you're like in one spot for a long period of time, that can cause like muscle cell death, okay? That can cause muscle cell death. And if your muscle cells are dying, remember potassium is primarily an intracellular ion, right? So that potassium sort of spills into the circulation. And if the potassium spills into the circulation, that can cause a hyperkalemia, right? So that can cause like a peaked T wave, right, on an EKG. But some other high yield things you want to remember is that how do you treat hyperkalemia? And then I'll talk about the urinary findings. The thing is, hyperkalemia can be treated in many ways, right? So the first thing you do is you give calcium gluconate, right? That sort of stabilizes the myocardium, right? You can also give calcium chloride. That also does the same thing. Another thing you can do is you can basically try to increase the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, okay? The sodium potassium ATPase pump, remember, that pumps sodium out of the three sodiums out of the cell and two potassiums in, right? So you can basically redistribute potassium from the extracellular environment to the intracellular environment by increasing the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So how do you do that? There are two main ways you can do that, right? Actually, the fastest way and probably the preferred way of doing that is to give insulin. So insulin increases the activity of that pump, okay? Well, you also give the insulin with glucose, right? Because you don't want to make your patient hypoglycemic and die, right? That's not ideal. That's never ideal, right? So you give insulin plus glucose. The insulin will increase the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. And the thing you can also do is to give a beta 2 agonist, right? Like albuterol. That increases the activity of the pump. That basically redistributes the potassium to the intracellular environment. Another thing you can do for hyperkalemia is to sort of take advantage of the proton potassium antipodder that's found on the surface of pretty much every cell, right? So if you give sodium bicarb, you'll create like metabolic alkalosis in the blood. That alkalosis will draw hydrogen ions out of cells. As hydrogen ions are being drawn out of cells, potassium goes in the reverse direction. So again, that redistributes the potassium to the intracellular environment. And then a drug you could actually give, drugs you could give to help you like physically get rid of potassium. One is you can give a diuretic like a loop, like a furosemide. That'll help you get rid of potassium in the urine because remember, loop diuretics make your volume down, right? So that increases the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? So you basically waste that potassium in the urine. And then one other thing you can do is you can give K-exalate. K-exalate, they call it like sodium polystyrene sulfonate, if I'm not mistaken. So that K-exalate, the way I remember is it makes K exit out of your body, okay? K-exalate makes K exit out of your body. Although it's not used much anymore, it basically binds up potassium and you get rid of it in your poop. But no one really uses it anymore because it can cause like bowel necrosis, okay? So the urinary labs in a patient with rhabdomyolysis, the big thing you want to remember is that your urine will be positive for blood, right? But it will be negative for red cells on urine microscopy, okay? Because it's primarily myoglobin that you're seeing on your urine dipstick. And again, no right thinking question writer will say, oh, patient was found down, alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. The urine was positive for blood on dipstick, but negative for red cells, right? No one is going to do that. If not, everyone will crush step one if they wrote questions like that. The way they'll probably present that is they'll give you like a urinalysis on step one, and you'll see that the blood will be like 3+ or 4+, right? So that means like, oh, this patient has a lot of like hematuria, if you may. But then they will say that you do like urine microscopy and you see like 0 to 2 red blood cells per high power field. That's pathognomonic for rhabdomyolysis, right? Because it's like you're seeing 4+ blood on dipstick, but you're like, wait, 0 to 2 red cells per high power field? That's literally like no hematuria at all, okay? So that's a classic way that rhabdomyolysis may present with labs on exams. Okay. Now, patient recently in a motor vehicle accident, systolic blood pressure in the 60s, right? So this patient potentially has a prerenal AKI, okay, because their volume down. So in a prerenal AKI, the thing is your volume down, right? So that will increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? So because angiotensin 2 goes up, remember I said that the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus responds to that angiotensin 2, so you make a lot of ADH. ADH helps you reabsorb urea. Right, it basically inserts like some urea transporters in the distal nephron, so you reabsorb a ton of urea. So because you're reabsorbing more like BUN and you're not necessarily reabsorbing creatinine, your BUN to creatinine ratio actually goes up, so it's more than 20 in perirenal AKI. Because aldosterone is elevated because your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is revved up, you'll reabsorb a lot of sodium, right, at the level of like the distal convoluted tubule with that sodium chloride symporter, and also at the level of the principal cell, right, with that INEC channel, right? So that can basically reduce your urinary sodium, right? So your urinary sodium will be less than 20 in a prerenal AKI. And then again, because you're reabsorbing a ton of sodium, your FeNO will be less than 1%. And because again, you're reabsorbing a ton of sodium to try to conserve volume, right, water sort of follows alongside, right? So your urinary osmolarity will be really high. It'll be like greater than 500. You'll have a concentrated urine. Okay. Now, the thing is, the urinary labs in a patient with prerenal AKI is actually the same as the urinary labs in a patient that has any kind of glomerulonephritis, right? So that's sort of like a lead into the next part, last part of this question that says, oh, how will these urinary labs be differentiated from the urinary labs expected from an individual with hematuria 2 weeks after a recent upper respiratory infection? The thing is, if you're 2 weeks out from if you have hematuria 2 weeks after a recent URI, hopefully you're thinking about post-streptococcal or glomerulonephritis, okay? So PSGN. PSGN is a kind of nephritic syndrome, okay? So acute glomerulonephritis actually has like the BUN creatinine being like greater than 20, urinary sodium being like less than 20, the FeNO being like less than 1%, and the urine osmolarity being greater than 500. But the thing is, you have like red blood cell casts in the urine if you have a glomerulonephritis versus prerenal AKI that usually has nothing in the urine. Or if you see something, you may see like hyaline casts, right? Basically, you find hyaline casts in any person that has a concentrated urine if they are volume down, okay? Those hyaline casts are usually made of like something known as a TAM Hosphor protein. And again, to sort of round out this slide, the most common kind of AKI is acute tubular necrosis, right? So like intrarenal AKI. And one last thing I will just say is acute tubular necrosis can be caused by like the aminoglycosides, right? So your 30S bactericidal inhibitors and vancomycin. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. So diuretic associated with a combination of hypokalemia, hypocalcemia, hypomagnesemia, metabolic alkalosis, sulfur allergies, and ototoxicity, right? That'll be your loop diuretic, right? So remember, your loop diuretics, they make you volume down, so that increases the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So aldosterone, right, through the mechanism I've discussed many times already, right, you basically waste potassium in your urine, so you get a hypokalemia with that. Remember that loop diuretics, right, they inhibit that sodium potassium 2 chloride symporter at the level of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. So if they inhibit that transporter, right, you basically do not reabsorb potassium. So again, that can cause hypokalemia. But another thing that can happen is because you're not reabsorbing that potassium, remember that ROMK channel I talked about, you basically don't have that coupled release of potassium into the lumen or the urine side basically of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. So you never really create that positive charge that helps you paracellularly reabsorb magnesium and calcium, okay? So you can get a hypocalcemia and hypomagnesemia with a loop diuretic, right? And remember, again, loop diuretics make you volume down. That revs up your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? So if you sort of think about aldosterone at the level of the alpha intercalated cell, you increase the activity of that proton pump. Okay, so you're basically dumping a lot of protons in the urine, so that can also cause a metabolic alkalosis. Okay, and basically your loop diuretics are ototoxic and they have sulfa allergies, with the exception of ethacrynic acid. Now, the alternative therapy from the same drug class that avoids the associated sulfur allergy, again, that's ethocrinic acid. The limiting side effect with ethocrinic acid is that it's super, super ototoxic, right? So it's something you don't use if you don't have to, okay? And really, one sort of thing I guess I want to mention here is that your loop diuretics and also your thiazides, they actually increase the production of prostaglandins, okay? So that's actually one mechanism behind the blood pressure lowering effect of your thiazides and your loops. But your, yeah, both of them, right, is one, they make your volume down, right? So you decrease your blood volume, decrease your blood pressure that way. But another thing they also do is they increase the synthesis of prostaglandins, right? So that dilates your vasculature. So that essentially decreases your systemic vascular resistance, right? So that's why, in general, for if a patient is taking these diuretics, like a loop or a thiazide, right, you kind of want to avoid taking NSAIDs alongside, because that sort of blunts the blood pressure lowering effects of your loop diuretics and your thiazides, right? And the genetic disease that's like taking a loop diuretic, right, that's a Bader syndrome. Remember, it's autosomal recessive inheritance, okay? And then if a patient taking a loop diuretic, right, has a flank pain and hematuria, that should get you thinking about nephrolithiasis, a kidney stone. Okay, remember, loop diuretics, right, they cause a hypocalcemia, but they cause hypercalciuria, so they increase your risk of having a calcium kidney stones. Okay. Now, next question. I've talked about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system already, talked about the functions of angiotensin 2. The stimuli for the upregulation of that pathway, right, is if, for example, you activate beta-1 receptors. Activation of beta-1 receptors increases the activity of your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, so that makes you release more renin. If you hypoperfuse your afferent arterial for any reason, right? So let's assume you have renal artery stenosis or fibromuscular dysplasia, or you're taking an NSAID, right? Remember, NSAIDs decrease the synthesis of prostaglandins. So that causes a constriction of the afferent arterial, right? So that sends less blood to the JG cells, basically see less blood. Those can all increase the activity of your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and you secrete more renin that way, okay? And next part of this question says, what happens to the concentration of angiotensin 2 if an experiment is done comparing the blood in pulmonary arteries and pulmonary veins, right? So remember, this can be a nice experimental question on the USMLEs. Remember, your pulmonary capillaries contain an angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE, okay? So really, if you compare the concentration of angiotensin 2 between your pulmonary vein and your pulmonary artery, the angiotensin 2 concentration should be a lot higher in the pulmonary veins, right? Because basically, angiotensin 1 goes through the endothelial cells of the pulmonary capillaries. They express ACE that converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, okay? So your angiotensin 2 levels should be much higher in the pulmonary veins compared with the pulmonary arteries, okay? And really, the two hormones that encourage diuresis in the setting of CHF, those are AMP and BMP. AMP, atrial natriuretic peptide, should come from the atria, right? And then BMP, that name is kind of a misnomer. Brain natriuretic peptide does not come from the brain. It actually comes from the ventricles. So sort of think about it as VNP in your mind. So ventricular natriuretic peptide, even if that's not what it's termed, okay? So those are hormones, right? So if you have CHF, let's assume blood is sort of collecting in your heart, that distends the heart, that increases the synthesis of AMP and BMP, okay? Those things actually dilate the afferent arterial, okay, and constrict the efferent arterial, right? So if you do that, that should raise your GFR, right, and basically encourage diuresis. And the thing these hormones do is that they actually inhibit the synthesis of renin, so they effectively dial down your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So they basically like encourage diuresis, right? They prevent you from reabsorbing like sodium and water and all that stuff in the nephron. So they make you, unlike angiotensin 2 that increases GFR but makes you reabsorb more stuff, ANP and BMP increase GFR, but they actually blunt the activity of the renin-angiotensin system. So they actually make you waste a lot of urine. And the thing that happens with these drugs is that they work through cyclic GMP, right? So they're actually pretty good vasodilators. So because they are very good vasodilators, they decrease systemic vascular resistance that way, right? So they can lower blood pressure. And the one thing I will just say is that these hormones, AMP and BMP, they're actually broken down by an enzyme known as neprilysin. Okay, neprilysin breaks down AMP and BMP to inactive stuff. So if you were to give a drug that's a neprilysin inhibitor, like sacubitril, for example, that will prevent the breakdown of AMP-BMP, so you can potentiate their effects. Those drugs are actually being investigated as treatments for CHF. In fact, there's this drug known as Entresto. It's a combination of an ARB, valsartan, and sacubitril, which is a neprilysin inhibitor. It's actually being used right now, actually, in the treatment of CHF. Okay, good. So next question, PTH in relation to the kidney. So PTH, right? Remember, I said that it's also known as the phosphate trashing hormone. Earlier in this podcast, I said that at the level of the PCT, right, it effectively causes you to endocytose those sodium phosphate symporters that you find at the level of the proximal tubule. Okay, so that decreases the reabsorption of phosphate. So PTH should lower your blood phosphate levels, right? For calcium, if you go to the distal convoluted tubule, in fact, let me just real quick talk about the distal convoluted tubule. So the distal convoluted tubule has simple cuboidal epithelium. I'll sort of establish that fact. Next thing is, if you look at the urine side, so the apical side of the distal convoluted tubule, you have a couple of transporters, right? So the first one is like a sodium chloride symporter, okay? That symporter basically lets in sodium, lets in chloride. And that makes sense, right? Because you're maintaining electron neutrality by having one positive charge and one negative charge. Another thing you find on the apical side is you actually have a channel that helps you reabsorb magnesium. I'll just sort of throw that out there, though that's kind of low yield for step one. And then another transporter you'll find is a calcium transporter. That calcium transporter is actually found on the apical side as well, and its activity is actually increased by PTH. So that's actually how PTH helps you reabsorb calcium. It helps you reabsorb calcium at the level of the distal convoluted tubule, okay? And then on the blood side, right, you obviously have the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So the basolateral side, you have the sodium potassium ATPase pump. But in addition, you have a sodium calcium exchanger that brings in sodium into the cell. Again, that kind of makes sense, right? That's a kind of like antiport, but it's a secondary active transport mechanism. You bring in sodium into the cell and then you extrude calcium into the bloodstream, okay? So that's kind of like a high yield thing you want to keep in mind. Okay. And so the genetic syndrome that's a similar phenotype to taking a thiazide, that's Gittleman syndrome. That's also autosomal recessive inheritance. Okay. And again, I've said that the distal tubule has a simple cuboidal epithelium, but it has no microvilli, unlike the proximal tubule. Now, the osmolarity of the tubular fluid compared to the blood osmolarity, right? Remember, the distal tubule is permeable only to salt. It's not permeable to water. So your tubular fluid actually becomes hypotonic relative to your plasma fluid, okay? And then the other hormone that operates at the DCT, that will be your... let's see. Sorry, again, I apologize for all the arms. I give these lectures mostly from memory. Aldosterone, right? So aldosterone increases the activity of that sodium chloride symporter that I just mentioned that you find on the apical side. So that's the other hormone besides PTH that acts at the level of the DCT. And then of the different diuretics, which is most appropriately used for calcium nephrolithiasis prophylaxis? It's actually your thiazides. You actually do not want to use loops for this. Remember, loops, they waste calcium in the urine, right? So they cause hypercalciuria. That's bad for a person that has a history of a calcium or kidney stones. So what's the mechanism behind thiazides being useful for prophylaxis against the calcium nephrolithiasis, right? So the mechanism is kind of complicated, but it's actually kind of cool and actually makes perfect sense. So the thing is, I said that thiazides inhibit the sodium chloride symporter that you find on the apical side of the distal convoluted tubule, right? So the DCT. If you inhibit that sodium chloride symporter, right, what happens to the intracellular concentration of sodium in the DCT? It should go down, right? If it goes down, so if the intracellular concentration of sodium goes down, and we know that sodium already is primarily an extracellular ion, what happens to the gradient of flow of sodium into the cell? So like from the basolateral side to the intracellular environment of a DCT cell. What should happen to that gradient of flow? It should increase, right? Because If you're lowering the intracellular concentration of sodium by blocking that sodium chloride symporter, and you're keeping the amount of sodium on the outside of the cell fixed, that should make more sodium, that should make the gradient like steeper, right, to bring more sodium into the cell. If you make that gradient steeper, you basically increase that secondary active transport around the sodium-calcium exchanger, right? So a lot of sodium comes in because the gradient is stronger, so more calcium gets pumped out into the blood side, right? So the basolateral side, okay? And if you're pumping out more calcium through that sodium-calcium exchanger, that should also lower the intracellular concentration of calcium at the distal convoluted tubule. So again, walk with me some more. If the intracellular concentration of calcium goes down some more in the DCT, right, that calcium transporter that's on the apical side, you have increased activity of that transporter, right? Because it's like a facilitated diffusion transporter, if you may, right? So because there are lower amounts of calcium inside the cell, you just reabsorb even more calcium through that apical calcium channel, okay? So that's how thiazide diuretics can cause hypercalcemia. So they increase the amount of calcium in your urine, in your blood, but they cause hypocalciuria. They decrease the amount of calcium in your urine, right? So that is why your thiazide diuretics are pretty good for prophylaxis against the calcium or nephrolithiasis. So again, they cause hypercalcemia and hypocalciuria. So that's the mechanism behind those two findings. Now, the next question says a 25-year-old male is rushed to the ED by ambulance. After passing out in his friend's apartment, he started complaining of severe flank pain about 30 minutes before he passed out. His blood pressure en route to the ED is 65 over palpable. That's bad news, obviously. A fast ultrasound conducted in the ED reveals an oblique structure with echogenic masses around the left kidney. A similar lesion is also found in the right kidney. The patient has a history of intellectual disability and has multiple hypopigmented macules on his skin. 3 years ago, the patient underwent a neurosurgical procedure for the removal of several benign tumors. So what's your diagnosis, right? So hopefully you're thinking about tuberous sclerosis, right? So if you see a renal mass in tuberous sclerosis, right, hopefully you're thinking about a renal angiomyolipoma, right? So if you sort of do a biopsy of that, you'll see like angio, right? So blood vessels, myo, you'll see muscle, and lipoma, right? So you'll see fat cells, right? So a renal angiomyolipoma is associated with tuberous sclerosis, right? And multiple hypopigmented macules on the skin, right? Those are your ash leaf spots. Please don't forget that a tuberous sclerosis is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, okay? Now, next slide. I've talked about the thiazide diuretic mechanism of action. It inhibits the sodium chloride symporter at the level of the DCT. The representative examples, right, so there's like HCTZ, hydrochlorothiazide, there is chlorthalidone, right, there is metolazone, and then there's one known as indapamide. Those last three are actually more commonly tested because hydrochlorothiazide, if they put it on an NBMA exam, everyone will get the question correct, right, because it already has thiazide in the name. And then calcium balance with thiazide reuse, right? So again, thiazides cause hypercalcemia and hypocalciuria. I already discussed the mechanism in the previous slide. If you compare thiazides to LOPs, right? So which is associated with a high risk of hyponatremia. So many people erroneously think that LOPs have a higher risk of hyponatremia. That's not necessarily true. That's actually more with thiazides. So let me discuss the mechanism behind that. The thing is, if you're thinking about your sodium concentration in the body, that's basically like sodium over water, right? That's one fact I want to establish. Second fact I want to establish is that loop diuretics, we already said that they work at the level of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. They essentially inhibit the sodium potassium 2 chloride symporter, okay? Now, that sodium potassium 2 chloride symporter is actually heavily responsible for the ions that creates that medullary concentration gradient. So the thing is, if you take a loop diuretic, because of its mechanism of action, first things first, you're losing sodium in the urine. That's the first thing. But the second thing that also happens is that you are destroying your medullary concentration gradient. So because you're destroying your medullary concentration gradient, you will not be able to reabsorb water at the medulla of the nephron. So you're losing a lot of sodium, but you're also losing a lot of water, right? So you're proportionally losing sodium and water. So you actually don't get that bad of a hyponatremia with a loop diuretic. Contrast that with a thiazide. A thiazide, right, blocks the sodium chloride synthetase at the DCT, makes you lose sodium in the urine, right? But the thing is, your thiazides actually do not really make you lose water, okay? That's why thiazides are not very strong diuretics. Loop diuretics are actually the most powerful kind of diuretic, right? So thiazides, because the sodium chloride synthetase at the DCT is not primarily responsible for the medullary concentration gradient, you actually retain water quite well. I mean, you don't lose as much water. Let's put it that way. You don't lose as much water if you're taking a thiazide, right? So you're losing all the sodium, but you're not losing as much water. You can see how that sort of sets you up for hyponatremia, because the numerator in that sodium over water fraction, right, is going down a lot, but the denominator is not going down proportionally, unlike what you have with loops, okay? So actually, thiazides have a higher risk of a hyponatremia. Now, how is a nephrogenic DI secondary to lithium use treated, right? So nephrogenic DI is treated with ENaC channel blockers if it's being caused by lithium use. Remember, lithium, right, is if you go back to sort of like general chemistry from college, lithium and sodium is sort of in the same group. Lithium, I think, is like element 3. Sodium is like element 11, but they all have just one electron in the outermost shell, right? So they kind of have similar properties. In fact, lithium is a little smaller than sodium, right? So if you sort of think about it, the principal cell of the collecting duct, right, sodium uses that ENaC channel. Lithium, being smaller, having a similar charge, could potentially also use that same channel, right? So can you sort of see where I'm going with this? Lithium can go through that ENaC channel, and by going through that ENaC channel, it can sort of screw up the signaling cascade of ADH. Remember, ADH works on the blood side, right? So the basolateral side, on vasopressin V2 receptors, which are GS coupled, okay? So lithium uses that ENaC channel to gain access to the principal cell to cause nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So if you gave an ENaC channel blocker like amiloride or triamterene, you could potentially reverse or prevent lithium-induced nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. And why am I making such a fuss about this? I'm making a fuss about this because, in general, for nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, you can give a thiazide diuretic. Works pretty well for nephrogenic DI, right? But the thing is, nephrogenic DI that is specifically caused by lithium, you do not use thiazides, and here's why. I don't necessarily have the time to go into the mechanism. If you're interested, just send me a message or something, and I'll try to break it down for you. But basically, the rule you want to remember is that anything that makes your volume down or anything that increases the activity of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system will increase lithium toxicity. That's just kind of a rule you want to remember, right? So think about it. If you take a thiazide, that will decrease the activity of your renin-angiotensin. That will make your volume down. So that will increase the activity of your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So that will make you more lithium toxic. And I guess I will sort of throw you a bone here. The thing is, if your RAS system increases its activity, right, aldosterone will be doing a lot. And one of the things aldosterone does is to increase the activity of that ENaC channel that reabsorbs sodium. Well, I just told you that lithium also uses that channel to gain access to the principal cell. So if a patient takes a thiazide diuretic for nephrogenic DI from lithium, that'll make them volume down, that'll increase the activity of the RAS system, that'll make more aldosterone available, that'll increase the activity of the ENaC channel at the level of the principal cell, and that would make you basically reabsorb more lithium, so your lithium levels will rise much, and that can cause a more lithium toxicity, right? So that's not generally preferable. And then the metabolic derangements associated with thiazide use, right? So they cause like hypercalcemia. I already talked about the mechanism. They cause hypocalciuria. I already talked about the mechanism. But you've probably memorized this thing, like hyperglyc with thiazides, right? So it causes hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, hyperuricemia, hypercalcemia. Let me talk about the mechanisms behind the first two, right? So hyperglycemia and hyperlipidemia. The jury is still kind of out on this, but if you sort of read the literature, there is some thinking on why this may be the case, right? So the proposed thinking, if you may, is that if you sort of backtrack to some endocrinology, right, to how insulin is released, right? So insulin is obviously released from the beta cells in the pancreatic islets. So the thing that happens is the way insulin is released is that glucose, right, comes in through GLUT2 transporters for the pancreatic beta cells, right? And then by some magic of biochemistry, you form ATP. That ATP blocks potassium channels in the pancreatic beta cells, okay? And then by blocking potassium channels, you leak less potassium out of the pancreatic beta cell. That makes the cell depolarize and you squirt out insulin, okay? The thing is, so you need to block that potassium channel, make that cell depolarize, and then you make insulin. If you opened up that potassium channel for some bizarre reason, that cell will not depolarize and you will not make insulin in that case. So the thinking is that thiazide diuretics actually open up those potassium channels at the level of the pancreatic beta cells, okay? So if you open up those potassium channels, your pancreatic beta cells never depolarize, you never secrete insulin, right? Insulin's job is to lower your blood glucose levels, right? So if you cannot make insulin, your blood glucose levels will be high, hyperglycemia. If you do not release insulin, right, you do not upregulate fatty acid synthesis, right? So you do not store your fatty acids in adipocytes. So you could potentially get a hyperlipidemia with that. Another thing with insulin, right, is that, I mean, another thing with thiazides is that they can cause a hyperuricemia because they actually increase the reabsorption of uric acid at the level of the nephron. There are mechanisms behind that, but I don't have time to go into that right now. So I'm going to skip that. But remember that thiazides can cause a hyperuricemia. And the thing they do is they actually increase the reabsorption of uric acid. Okay. And then to sort of round out this slide. So the preferred agent for the management of hypertension with the following comorbidities, right? So like hypertension and osteoporosis. You want your blood calcium to be as high as possible if you have osteoporosis, right? So thiazides are probably a good choice there. Hypertension and BPH, right? BPH, you want to try to open up the bladder neck so that you can drain urine better. So think about an alpha-1 blocker like prazosin or terazosin for that purpose. It will lower your blood pressure but also open up the bladder neck. Remember, for BPH, you can also use a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor like finasteride and dutasteride because DHT, right, promotes the growth of the prostate. And then another thing you could do is if you have hypertension and diabetes, right, you can give an ACE inhibitor, right, or an ARB. Remember, in diabetes, you have non-enzymatic glycosylation of the efferent arterial. So that increases GFR, and that causes, like, intraglomerular hypertension, which can cause, like, hyperfiltration injury. So you can sort of slow down the death of a diabetic person's kidneys, by giving an ACE inhibitor, right? Because by blocking the synthesis of angiotensin II, you effectively... So by giving an ACE inhibitor, you make less angiotensin II. If you make less angiotensin II, you cause less constriction of the efferent arterial, right? So that basically dilates the efferent arterial. That decreases GFR, right? It decreases intraglomerular hypertension, and that sort of decreases the risk of hyperfiltration injury. So that sort of slows down damage of the kidneys in diabetic kidney disease, okay? And then if a patient has hypertension and hyperthyroidism, you can give a beta blocker for that purpose. Remember that hyperthyroidism, right, if you're going back to endocrine, the thing that helps you convert T4 to T3 is a 5' deiodinase in the periphery. That 5' deiodinase can be inhibited by beta blockers like propranolol. Okay, so hyperthyroidism plus hypertension, give a beta blocker for that. Okay, and again, I've talked about the electrolyte imbalances with thiazides. They cause hypokalemia, they cause metabolic alkalosis because they rev up your renin angiotensin aldosterone system because they make your volume down. Okay, and all diuretics have sulfur allergies with the exception of ethacrynic acid. Okay, so next slide. The three constituents of the glomerular filtration barrier. There are three things, right? So we have the endothelial cells that constitute the glomerular capillaries, okay? Remember, those are simple squamous cells, but they have fenestrations. And then the second thing is the glomerular basement membrane. Remember, it has a negative charge, okay? And that's created by heparan sulfate, okay? Remember that the GBM contains type 4 collagen, right? You actually make autoantibodies against that type 4 collagen in a good pasture syndrome. And then the third part of the glomerular filtration barrier, the podocyte food processes. Okay, remember, the podocytes constitutes the visceral layer of a Bowman's capsule. Okay, the visceral Bowman's whatever. Okay, and the capillary network of the glomerulus, again, simple squamous, has fenestrations. And a venous portal system, let me just sort of break this down, right? So sort of think about the liver, for example, right? So the liver has the sinusoidal capillaries. That's what I actually kind of did my research on in med school. But back to the real world, right? So you have sinusoidal capillaries in the liver. Those capillaries are fed by portal veins, and then they are drained by the hepatic vein, right? So usually, a set of capillaries are fed by arterioles and drained by venules, right? Yeah, fed by arterioles, drained by venules, right? But the thing is, in the kidneys specifically, you have something known as an arterial portal system. So your glomerular capillaries are fed by the afferent arterioles and drained by the efferent arterioles. That's kind of an arterial portal system. The reason why you may want to have stuff like that is if you want to regulate things, because think about it, right? If you have like a capillary system, you can, if you're sending things to a venule from a capillary, right, it goes all the way back to the heart and then you distribute it all around the body. But if you wanted to keep the local concentrations of things really high, right, you can just sort of say like, oh, from arterial to capillary to arterial as obtains in the kidney, or from like venule to capillary to venule as obtains in the liver, and also in the hypothalamic hypophysilla portal system. And then, last quick thing I'll talk about here, pathway of blood flow from the aorta. This is just, unfortunately, something you have to memorize. But basically, right, so from the abdominal aorta, the renal artery sort of comes off at the L1, L2. And then from the abdominal aorta, you form like the renal arteries. And then from the renal arteries, you form like segmental arteries. And then from segmental arteries, you form the lobar arteries. From lobar arteries, you form interlobar arteries. And then from those interlobar arteries, you form your arcuate arteries, right? It's called arcuate because it sort of takes a 90-degree turn if you look at those histologically. And then after that, you have your interlobular arteries, which then form your afferent arterioles. You then have your glomerular capillaries, and then you have your efferent arterioles, and then you form your peritubular capillaries. And then by some magic, you form the renal vein, and then you go all the way back to the IVC. Okay, so that is how blood basically flows from the aorta all the way back to the heart through the kidneys. Okay, so that's where I'm going to stop today. This podcast is kind of running long. I will continue this in the future, and we will go through that. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless.